This is Upstate's HealthLink on air. Linda Cohen here with you. Communication between healthcare providers and their patients can provide both healing and chilling effects. And these days, with all the added time pressures built into these interactions and the introduction of more and more technology impacting on that relationship, one of the chief complaints patients have seems to be that doctors don't have the time to really talk to them. But joining us today to tell us more about a new program designed to combat this trend are Dr. Stephen Knoll, Residency Program Director in the Department of Medicine at Upstate Medical University, and Chief Residents Dr. Christine Granato and Dr. Luke Uhiko, both at Upstate Medical University as well. Welcome to you all. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
So, Dr. Knoll, I know you have been kind of prime mover in this program. You actually came and talked to us about it on the show a little while ago. Tell us about this program and what it's hoping to accomplish.
Well, I think it's important to first understand why we're doing this. And if I can just give you a few statistics. If we go back to 2009, there was some data that came out of Massachusetts highlighting that patients that were hospitalized, about 50% had absolutely no idea who their doctors were. There was another third who were never involved in decisions about their own care. Additional statistics, I use a few numbers. The number 18, which highlights the number of seconds before a doctor interrupts a patient when we are trained to be asking open-ended questions during an interview.
Wow. That's chilling right there.
Yes, absolutely. Another would be the number 25. 25% of patients by a particular study received their cancer diagnosis in some fashion other than in person with their physician. And then finally, the number 33. So 33% of physicians that were surveyed in a study that came out in 2012 either thought it was okay to or have in fact lied to their patients.
Wow. And, tell me more about that. In what respect? How so?
Well, the questions were very general questions, so it's hard to appreciate the context of why the physicians may have felt it was okay to lie. Certainly, there are other cultures where it is felt to be appropriate to not disclose, for example, cancer diagnoses.
So is it kind of harkening back to that more paternalistic time when the doctor knows best and the patient really doesn't have to know, we'll take care of you kind of thing?
I think that that plays a large role, certainly in some cultures. I think there may be some religious connotations as well that enter into there. But certainly in the United States, I don't think the religious connotation is a factor. The paternalistic nature, yeah, I think it may still play a role.
May it also be, it just strikes me, to all of you sitting here, and you two, you chief residents, you're really closer to this whole thing in terms of training. Is it possible that some young doctors don't necessarily feel prepared to give that kind of bad news, potentially?
Absolutely.
I don't think instead they kind of cover themselves by softening or maybe omitting rather than actually overtly twisting the facts.
I think that's a fair statement.
So tell us, what did you do? You said the reasoning
right.
That
was the reasoning, and so I took it upon myself to create a program that would allow my house staff to hopefully learn or begin that process of trying to master communication skills, because it's clearly so vitally important in terms of the doctor-patient relationship. The only other number I would point out is the number 15. 15% of patients claim to dislike their doctors.
Wow.
And so
that has major ramifications, which we'll get to in a minute.
Right.
I want to hear from the residents as well. But just briefly, tell me what the name of the program is and what it stands for and what the mission is.
Sure. So the name of the program is Learning to Talk, TALK, for treating all like kin, i.e. family.
Wow.
And it's a exercise in which I put my house staff into challenging communication type situations where they're given a very brief narrative. They know exactly what's being expected of them. We have standardized actors that are playing these roles, and the situation then takes place. And then the house staff are given instantaneous feedback, specifically addressing how they were made to feel, the patient that is, how they were made to feel by the house officer. They get feedback from faculty, including myself, our chair, Dr. Iannuzzi, and former Dean William Williams. And then probably the most instructive is that the house officer has to view themselves on video and then fill out a checklist so that they actually get to see things that are so important to communication. Most people think it's all about verbal when in fact it's primarily nonverbal.
Body language, all of that.
That's right.
So Dr. Granato, you participated in this program in training. Tell us about it. What did it feel like to you and what impact did it have on your development?
You know, I think it's a fantastic program. When we first started it, I think a lot of us didn't really know what to expect going into the room and whatnot. But after going through it, I think one of the most eye-opening things is actually watching yourself and, like Dr. Knoll said, is seeing the patterns of the things that you say and also looking at your body language and how that could be portrayed by the patient. Mm-hmm. So certainly setting up patient rapport is one of the hardest things to do, but also one of the most important things to do in our job because that's what sets up the trust and the physician-patient relationship.
So how long does the program run? I mean, in your experience, how many sessions did you have, for example?
We did one a year. It was typically during our ambulatory care block, and that has since changed since we've graduated because they no longer have that rotation, so it's set up during their continuity clinic elective. And so we do it once a year, and so we did it twice, I think, correct? Because it started during our second year.
You do it once a year, but we do many cases within that one particular encounter.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's typically a morning, so about 4 hours.
Okay.
One session would have several cases and all different experiences.
Different situations. Dr. Hiko, what was your experience going through that?
So it was very different for me. I had never really seen myself in that kind of situation. So the difficult thing about medical school is you have a lot of time learning about clinical competency and patient cases, but you never are
like
really...
Decision-making, facts, understanding.
Finding a diagnosis, how to treat a patient. But you're never really taught how to deliver bad news, how mm-hmm. to talk about life and death and code status. And for many of us, the first time we actually do it in person is doing the real thing in residency. And there's a lot of discomfort, which is a barrier to establishing good patient care and rapport. And seeing myself do it, and all the things I was doing while I was watching myself, and hearing what the standardized patients had to say about how I made them feel was a really big eye-opener.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and I'm here along with Dr. Stephen Knoll, Christine Granato, and Luke Yuhiko, and we're talking about this talk program here at Upstate, trying to get medical students and soon-to-be doctors prepared to talk to their students. So what do you think, Dr. Luhiko, were the biggest barriers in your own experience to effective communication with your patients?
I think barriers go two ways, one on the patient side and one on the physician side. So for the patient, toward the doctor, there's culture, religion, level of education or ability to understand certain medical conditions. But for the part of the physician, it's also the ability of the physician to explain things at varying levels. As physicians, we tend to forget the difference between regular lay language and medical jargon.
Yeah.
And we tend to speak
in a
different quote-unquote language.
Yes.
And it gets very difficult sometimes explaining things and remembering what it was like for us before we were in medical school. And then there's the lack of comfort, which Christine and Dr. Knoll were alluding to.
How do you get to be more comfortable with things like telling a patient they have a short amount of time to live or they have a serious diagnosis?
Practice.
I would agree. Practice. Yes. Practice, mm-hmm. practice, practice. And I think the best way is through simulation.
So this idea of bringing actors mm-hmm. who are pretending to be patients gives you an opportunity to really try your skills and hone your skills.
It's interesting, too, because there were times going through the program, the Learning to Talk program, that I walked out of the room thinking, I did a really good job. And then when I went back in and listened to what the patient had to say and also then watching myself on the TV afterward, that made me realize, geez, there are a lot of things I can improve on, and I really didn't do such a great job that I thought I did. So
it sounds like a crucial element in training. Would you agree, Dr. Knoll?
Absolutely.
And is it being done elsewhere in this country as well?
It is. I wouldn't say that it's being done at all schools or all residency programs. I would say that there are pockets around the country that are doing this. I would like to believe that what we're doing here is a bit more unique, and that we also have exercises where it's not just about talking to the patients, but it's also about communicating with medical students, for example. Mm-hmm. And
so at all levels of care. Wouldn't you say that it would be important for all health professionals of any kind, whether it be an X-ray technician or someone else mm-hmm. who deals with patients,
absolutely,
to learn how to communicate?
Yeah, absolutely.
I think the one thing I know as a patient, having been in hospital and in clinical settings, that there's that fear that really pervades your experience, and that sense of anonymity, or actually isolation. You know, you don't have your regular clothes on, you don't have your family mm-hmm. around you perhaps, and you feel kind of alone mm-hmm. and frightened. And the idea of a physician coming forward and reaching you and touching you on some level, communicating with you, has got to be is incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely agree.
So in your experience, is it working in terms of as a teacher? Are you seeing, as a residency director, are you seeing positive outcomes?
Well, I think the best way is for us to listen to our house staff. And the house staff seem to be responding positively to the experience. So I would say yes. But I think it may be still a little too early to say, because it's still a relatively new program.
When did it start, very briefly?
2008.
Okay, so, well, it's getting up there. And you both have been through it. Do you see from your own classmates that it's made a positive impact?
I actually just came off service as attending at the VA, and I worked directly with the senior resident, and he had to deliver some difficult news, and I basically said, it's on you. I want to see how you do. He did a fantastic job, and I know that what he learned in the Learning to Talk program certainly assisted him and gave him tools to allow him to do that.
This is such good news, and I'm so excited. I think it gives us all pause and heartens us in terms of the next generation of doctors. I want to thank you all for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen. My guests have been Dr. Stephen Knoll, Dr. Christine Granado, and Dr. Luke Yuhiko, all from Upstate Medical University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.